it's so dry. I don't have nothing. My throat's just dry, Dave.
I would go, Julian, after you introduce.
Were you okay?
Yeah.
Thank you, Counselor Hughes. Good afternoon, Counsel. Well, that was exciting.
Good afternoon.
So I'm here today, and I want to welcome Andrew McVicker, who has been the acting administrator at Hillsview Acres since mid-August, and also Ani Terry, who's the director of care of Queens Manor, who has been offering support to our residential care supervisor on site at Hillsview since August. And today we're here to give you kind of the Coles Notes version of what's been going on over the last year or so, bring you up to date. It's my understanding from our CAO that typically our administrator would come to council once a year with an update. My apologies, I didn't do that. So here we are to bring you all up to snuff with what's going on. Nope, see, doesn't work.
You're just making it bigger now.
I know. See? There we go. All right, so some background. The Region of Queens purchased the Hillsview Acres property in the 1800s, and it's been used for a couple of hundred years to house most of our vulnerable citizens. Can you guys see that? Yeah. In 1981, the facility was classified as a residential care facility, and in the year 2000, responsibility was transferred to the Department of Health and Wellness, which is now our Department of Seniors and Long-Term Care. So I'm going to let Andrew explain this, because this is one of the important lessons that I learned when I came in.
I'll just start by saying thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today and to wish you all, I'll start by wishing you all a Merry Christmas and a Happy Holidays. So the key difference, if we're going to really kind of get down to it, with the difference between long-term care and residential care is it really comes down to the level of mobility and nursing care that the resident requires. So long-term care facilities are options for people that have difficulty performing everyday tasks, such as dressing, bathing, and washroom use. Nursing home placement, and when we say nursing home, we're referring to, we use those phrases interchangeably. So a nursing home is a long-term care facility, is appropriate for people who are medically stable but have nursing needs that cannot be met through home care. Okay, so when we talk about residential care, we're talking about individuals where home care doesn't meet the needs of the person, but long-term care is not required in terms of the level of nursing care that is required. So it's a lower level of nursing care that's required. And residential care facilities provide people with personal care, so assistance with bathing and your basic activities of daily living, supervision and accommodation in a safe and supportive environment. And there is the key there in brackets. So people living in residential care facilities must have the ability to self-evacuate in the event of an emergency. So I am not a nurse, I'm an occupational therapist by trade, but I think, Ani, you could probably give us an example of a nursing task or procedure that you would see at Queens Manor that you might not see at Hillsview Acres, wouldn't see at Hillsview Acres.
Yeah, so it's really about frailty as well, and there is a spectrum of frailty, and our physicians in geriatrics use frailty scale to determine accommodation that would best suit an individual. So in the case of a nursing home, we're looking at someone that is moderately to severely frail. They require management of many and often multiple chronic disease processes. So diabetes, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, and then they're dealing with lifetime issues that may affect them neurologically, or it could be a substance use disorder, all kinds of reasons why somebody would be frail. So it's not so much about age, it's about frailty. So somebody, for example, in long-term care really needs to be monitored by a professional licensed nurse and physician team that are available 24/7. That doesn't happen in residential care facility. We have nurses during the day, but we don't have nurses at night. So that changes the ability to respond and assess the situations that arise. So that's one of the main differences. We do have individuals who couldn't manage to live in the community because they don't have the social support or the coping skills, and they need really a careful management of their chronic illness like diabetes. So we see some of the same disease processes and some of the same needs, but at a different level of frailty. And that's essentially the difference between the population we have in residential care facility versus long-term care. So people are more fragile, essentially, in the long-term care and can become very ill very quickly if we don't pick up on that.
And we'll have questions at the end if you guys want to answer any, okay?
So I'm going to speak quite a bit here to the funding models that long-term care facilities and residential care facilities fall under. And I'm actually really excited to talk about this, not because I have an inherent interest in math or finance. In fact, I struggle. But I think it's really important for people in decision-making capacities in long-term care and residential care to really understand how we are funded and some of the differences in how we are funded. So we are both long-term care and residential care facilities. We receive our budgets generally twice a year. So we'll get a budget from the Department of Seniors and Long-Term Care. We're actually getting it tomorrow. And then we get another one in the spring with some updates to it. Sometimes it's identical, but if they make adjustments to different areas, we will see it in a spring budget as well. So the budgets that we receive have always had what's called a protected envelope and an unprotected envelope. This policy has always been in place, but it hasn't really been enforced to the degree that it is about to be enforced. So you may have heard about this in the news, but on November 1st, the Department of Seniors released new policies around the protected and the unprotected envelope. Because it hasn't been enforced for, my understanding, is decades, they are giving facilities 6 months to adjust. So the protected envelope, it's if we think of it as a one-way street, okay? Your protected envelope is the funding that you receive for healthcare. If you think of it that way, for the direct care of the residents. So within the protected portion of your approved budget, you're looking at things like the salaries and benefits for your care team, your RNs, your LPNs, your CCAs, your RCAs, which is what we call CCAs in residential care, your recreation programmers, okay? So the people that are providing direct care to your residents. It also includes raw food, okay? And then all operations that pertain to providing care. So your medical supplies, your wound care supplies, your supplies in recreation, okay? So within the protected envelope, you can move funding around. And in fact, the department expects administrators to take their budgets and be creative. Because if you try to run a facility based strictly on the lines in the budget, and your goal is excellence and quality, you're going to struggle. Because every facility has its own unique needs, and it's in its own unique geographic area. And so you can move dollars around within the protected envelope. You cannot move dollars from the protected envelope to the unprotected envelope. It's a one-way street. You can move monies from the unprotected envelope into the protected envelope, because if you do that, you're increasing direct resident care, which is a good thing. The unprotected envelope are things like my salary as administrator. It's all of your admin staff. It's the salaries and benefits of your support staff, your laundry, your dietary, your environmental, and your maintenance. And it's your capital costs. It's the cost to operate the building. It's fuel. It's electricity. It's all those non-direct resident care costs. So like I said, the expectation from the department is that administrators take those budgets and they make them work. They work their budget. Okay. So an example I can give you at Queens Manor is we are not funded for a human resources manager. However, last year I created a human resource manager position within our unprotected envelope. And one of the primary tasks of that role is to get on top of workplace injuries, WCB type stuff, and really work towards maximizing our return to work plans and getting people back to work. Because you are funded at a fixed amount for your WCB rate, okay? That's in your unprotected envelope. So one way to get yourself some extra cash is to get your WCB rates down, because then you can play with that money and make it work for your facility. So while I don't have a line in my budget that says human resources manager, we are getting a lot of benefit from that position because we've gotten our WCB rate down below the provincial average, which means we keep some money. We make some money off WCB now. So we could get into the, I could sit here for hours and talk about the two envelopes and the nuances of it, but if I could stress, what's that?
Please don't.
I won't. But if I could just stress one thing, it's important to look beyond the lines of the budget as they are written. We don't get funding for a medical director. You need a medical, it's ridiculous. We don't get funding for a medical director, but we must have a medical director. So how do you make that happen? You work your budget. There are other sources of funding. I'll be really quick here.
Yeah,
sorry, Jordan. It's important to find other sources of funding as well. So you're looking at grants. You're looking at accessing emergency funding from the department. Generally, anything that comes up in terms of equipment not working, the boiler going, generator going on the fritz, anything over $5,000, you can go back to the department and ask for emergency funding, and that so that you're not dipping into your envelopes. Overcost funding for providing attendant care to residents. So if you have a resident that needs additional support for responsive behaviors, you can go after some extra funding there. But it's really important to have someone in place that can go after those monies when you need them and recognize when you need them. So that's funding and all the mental gymnastics that you have to do when it comes to funding in long-term care and residential.
So just a little glimpse, wanted to give you a snapshot of the situation right now. At Hillsview, we have 25 of our 29 beds are filled. Our 25th resident was admitted this morning, and we're delighted about that.
Can you speak up just a little?
Yes, sorry. we now have 25 of our 29 beds filled at Hillsview Acres. We filled the 25th bed this morning. There was an admission, which we're delighted about. It's interesting to note that 12% of our population of residents at Hillsview have been reassessed for needing long-term care. So it's an interesting kind of hybrid situation that we're in now. And we understand the need for that because there aren't beds available. So just bear that in mind as we think about our population and about the level of frailty. So we are fortunate in that we still can access support around behavior management, support around OTPT services that we would need. And right now we are providing a really warm and wonderful home for these folks as they're waiting. We don't know how long it could take. It could take a very long time. If their condition were to deteriorate suddenly, then they would require hospitalization or emergency placement in long-term care. But for now, they're safe with us. Interestingly enough, 42% of our residents require daily and consistent care to support them in their personal care and activities of daily living, which is a reasonably high number. I mean, they still function independently in many ways, and we try to encourage them to have as much of their capacity in use, but the reality is they are aging or they are becoming more frail. Residents with dementia, we hear this all the time out in the public domain. We know that dementia is on the rise, and 25% of our residents are on some aspect of that scale for dementia. And a lot of these dementias are progressive, we know that. We also have a heavy proportion of our residents have long-term mental health and addiction substance use disorder. disorder that we are managing. And that is one of the reasons why we are so grateful to have a facility like Hillsview Acres, because there are folks out in the community that wouldn't do well on their own and don't have the social supports or the coping mechanisms in place to be able to function well independently. And we are able to provide them with lots of the aspects of independent living, but at the same time, careful support. Okay, so we recently had our annual licensing visit, and we did very well. There was one minor deficiency, and it was related to air freshener, and I'll leave it at that. But we were very, very pleased with how well we did, and I have to credit the staff, particularly the leadership of Candace Weir, who did a phenomenal job getting staff on board and working together with me. And we've just had a really good 4 month run, and I've been delighted to work with her. The next time we can anticipate a licensing visit will be in 6 months when they do an unannounced semi-annual visit. So we are licensed and happy to say so until the December 1st, 2020.
Mm-hmm. Just one thing.
Please
do you mind?
No.
When you see one minor deficiency, I would say there's zero chance that you would ever hear us say there isn't, they don't find a deficiency. They come looking for deficiencies, and that's good. That's a good thing. And I think as taxpayers and residents of Nova Scotia, we have one of the most robust long-term care licensing models in the province, in the country. So don't be alarmed to see that there was a deficiency. That is expected. What's important, what I always look at is the nature of the deficiency. So I'll give you an example. 2 years ago, when we were in the middle of the pandemic, we were told by public health to make sure that we had hand sanitizer everywhere. We were told that on 1 week, we had licensing come in the next, and we got dinged for having hand sanitizer everywhere. So it's important to look at what they're finding, and you know, really doing a risk assessment around what are the risks of that deficiency.
That's helpful. So we did have an outbreak of COVID-19 in our facility in the summer, towards the end of the summer. And despite our best efforts, we were up against one of the biggest challenges in a facility, which is the internal infrastructure. And when it hit us, we were dealing with the reality of having only two sort of shared areas where people could sit and enjoy a smallish dining room that can accommodate people very nicely when there isn't a 6 foot separation requirement, but very challenging when there is. So despite all our efforts, the reality of shared rooms and minimum, a kind of poor ratio of toilets to residents, we were faced with the reality that in fact most of our residents did acquire COVID-19. I can say that we were very well supported by IPAC. Staff were very quick and to pivot and to respond to the direction that they were given. And they did an excellent job of maintaining as much wellness as they could in the facility during the outbreak. We were declared over by October 3rd, and that cleared cleared in our minds, thinking that we now had some immunity built up in our population that was natural, and that it would be another 120 days before we would need to re-immunize everybody. So that's going to happen in January, and I can share as well that everyone has received their flu vaccine, and we are currently doing well. So thank
we
you,
didn't
Andrew.
Rehearse that, by the way.
No, but the reality is, as hard as we try, if we're going to live with COVID and live with respiratory illness, we need to accept a certain level of risk. And as much as we manage it and we do passive screening with our staff every morning when they arrive at the facility, and people are very good about indicating if they're not feeling well, we're fortunate in that we've able to maintain really good staffing ratios. And I'm always willing to go in and work, which is something I enjoy on the floor with the residents. But at the same time, we have to look at the reality of our infrastructure, and we are not positioned to be in the best shape infection control-wise. As much as we try, that is just a fact. And we are looking forward to doing more training and more teaching with our staff to make sure that they are equipped and feel very able to manage. It's something we do in long-term care as well. Staff get tired of being told sometimes what to do, but we do keep the messaging going, and be aware of the risks that are out there. Staffing wise, what a great crew LG Acres has. Honestly, they're terrific people to work with. The biggest challenge we're facing right now is a lack of casual staff. But this afternoon, in a few minutes, Candace will be interviewing somebody for the casual maintenance position, and we're hopeful that that will be filled. We do have just had a nursing staff return from a year of mat leave recently, and we have another LPN that's returning in March. We've managed to fill our long-term care assistant position, which we are delighted to announce will be extended. Can I do that, Andrew?
Mm-hmm.
We're able to extend that funding from the Department of Seniors and Long-Term Care for another 6 months. So it was originally slated to go until the end of March, and now we are confident we can hire someone in that position until the end of September next year. So we have someone wonderful in place, and we will be looking at adding a second person on a part-time basis. We've also working really well with our collective bargaining unit. We really appreciate the communication that we have, very open and respectful. And we were able to recently work together to be able to provide one of our longstanding CCAs with the opportunity to go on an education leave and yet maintain employment to the level that she is able to. So I'm very excited to say that she will be training as an LPN, and we hope will be returning to us full time when she graduates in about 2 years.
So further to what Anya was saying about the challenges with the facility, as I know I've spoken in council before about this, we've had some continual challenges when it comes to capital investment in the facility. We've had continuous delays, and the ongoing supply chain issues have been horrendous. And despite the best efforts of Director Grant, we tried multiple ways to put these large jobs out to tender. The actual tenders came back sometimes twice what we were budgeted for. So the capital jobs that were approved in the 21-22 fiscal year have not been done. And those were the $93,000 washroom project that we had. We had the tub room, which was $91,000. That was all supposed to be part of one significant project, along with the door replacements. None of those were done because of the continual delays that we had with the issues that I raised up on this slide. Now, I would like to update you a little more on those in a moment, but before I do that, I want to just walk you through what we were approved to do for this year, which has been more successful. We've been able to secure 4 beds and mattresses, $12,000. We had a new dishwasher installed that was $13,000, and both of those were approved in the capital process last year. We had applied at the time for a roof repair, which was originally denied, then approved, and by the time I got it requoted, it had gone from $13,500 to $32,000, the cost, because the roof had deteriorated so much in that period of time, and the cost of labor and parts and shingles were exponentially higher. The Department of Seniors and Long-Term Care did approve us for the increased cost, so that is a very positive thing. So the current capital jobs that we have, capital projects that we have in progress, the heat pump, which was probably the biggest concern that we had, Director Grant worked very, very diligently to try and get this project off the ground. The problem was the home as it exists now was basically impossible. I don't know if you remember, to get it, to bring it up to code when it comes to the quality of an air exchange system was, I mean, it was over $1 million to do. So obviously that wasn't something that council could fund. We got special permission once we explained that to Department of Long-Term Care. We got special permission in writing to continue with the mini splits. And so it was a scaled down basis. So we finally got that project started this year. There's literally 2 covers outstanding on 2 of the mini splits. But other than that, it is done. So I put completed because I was like, this is done for me. The roof repair is ongoing right now. We actually got emergency funding for a replacement fire escape. All of that is the replacement of the existing fire escape. So we have a wooden fire escape now that needs needs repair, it's gonna be replaced as a wooden fire escape, and one of the things that we're gonna put on our capital list for next year is a new fire escape. So we'll probably be to code with a pad and a metal stairs and you know, a proper fire escape. We also had an inspection by Department of Environment, and they identified an issue with some of the taps not mixing properly and the water being too hot, so we had to get $3,600 worth of special mixers installed, but we were also able to get that with the help of Andrew. We had an emergency funding request, and we were able to get funding for that, so that was really good. I was really pleased about that.
And I could just, if you don't mind.
No, go ahead.
This is certainly not unique to Hillsview Acres, the challenges with capital over the last 3 years. We had at the manor a $500,000 HVAC project that was approved in February of 2020. I think we can all remember what was going on right after that. And so we are just getting to that now. So we weren't even allowed to allow contractors into the building to do the work back when it should have been done. So this is not unique to Hillsview Acres at all. This is province-wide in all facilities.
Yeah. So currently we have our maintenance person working on the door replacements. He has gone out and looked for some pricing quotes on that. Anya, Andrew, and myself have been working together. We made a request to the department. The funding for the tub room was through infection prevention and control, which is different from capital funding because it's more focused on what can you do to prevent infection. So we were basically said, they said, yep, you can use that money for the tub room renovation, but we're gonna scale it back because remember it was supposed to be part of that whole end of that building was supposed to be gone with the stairwell and washrooms upstairs. Now we're just gonna look at the tub room itself. And that we had Peter from Queens Manor, who was amazing, come out to Hillsview and look at the room and talk to Anya and Candace and look at what the potential could be to use this money. So we have the $91,000 that we had for funding from 2021-22, plus we still have the $93,000 from the washroom project that got canceled. So we're hopeful that, you know, if we need to borrow some from the 93, we will. I'll ask forgiveness after the fact if so, but having this new tub room will be a real game changer. That's really the impression that I got when I got up there, because obviously I don't work in the facility, but just looking at some of the potential for that space, I think it's going to be a real game changer for the residents and a lot safer for the staff too, which is a really positive thing.
I'm going to interrupt again.
Yep, go ahead.
Last week there was quite a large announcement that was made at the provincial level around funding in long-term care and residential care. And one of the areas is in capital, and they are going to go back and look at all declined projects over the last, I don't know what the window is, but and revisit a lot of declined projects and invest in them. So there may be some opportunities there. I haven't spoken to you about that yet, Joanne.
No, that's fine.
Yep.
And one of the other things I will bring to your attention is that we had applied for emergency funding for an elevator refit. To Anya's point earlier about frailty and mobility, there are residents that live on the second floor. So we have a working elevator, and staff also use the elevator to go down, up and down with medicines and things like that with their carts. So our elevator is at end of life, and there's a part in the elevator, it's a key component of the operation of the elevator, that is at end of life. And we were notified 6 months ago, actually probably closer to 8 months ago now, by the elevator manufacturer that if these particular parts die, that there's no replacement. So their suggestion was to get a new electronics panel then and have that elevator refitted. It was an $86,000 job. It was denied by the Department of Seniors and Long-Term Care. So right now what we're doing is we're gonna put it on our capital list, which was suggested by them. And we're hopeful that we can get the elevator through to there. I mean, it's a gamble because we don't know if this whatever it is panel is gonna break for next year. We have no idea. So unfortunately there's no redundancies. If the elevator is broken, there will be issues with residents getting up the stairs, but we're not gonna go until that happens, but I just wanted to give you a heads up, should I have to come to council in 3 weeks and say, guess what, the elevator broke. So, our maintenance man was looking into trying to source extra parts for the elevator, this particular board, which would have cost between $5,000 and $6,000 per part. And I said, you know, no, because again, it's a gamble. Is it there? Is it not? Is it the right part? There's an issue with the elevator perhaps being out of service for a number of days while this is being done. So all that we'll have to factor in if it becomes an issue, but I just wanted to give you all a heads up on that. So some unbudgeted expenses for this year, and I talked about this in our quarterly financial report. So we had to hire some agency staff this year. So right now we're just under $60,000 in cost for that. We had operational support from Queens Manor, which I have to say was money well spent. I could not have gotten through this last 4 months without either of you, so thank you very much. We also invested significantly in training costs to bring all of our staff up to date with all of their training. That included training costs themselves, plus additional staff to cover with the agency staff so that our staff could go and attend all this training to make sure that everybody was up to date when the licensing inspection was done. And our most significant increase really for us, I mean, obviously there's fuel, but we only have like the furnace, but food is a big one for us. We've had at least 15%. There's I think there was a food for, what was it, the fish went up from $40 to $85 for so much for like a 10-pound bag for so many servings. So, you know, if you look, if you do the math, the amount of money per meal per resident, it's, the numbers are not, they're not good. Like, I don't know how the, Tara and the kitchen, how they do it.
$2.40 a meal.
Yeah, I have no idea how they do it, but they seem to be okay. And to that end, I just want to say, when we talk about the protected and unprotected envelope, and Andrew's saying that that's actually going to be enforced now, that was never before. This is the first time I've heard of it in terms of him having that conversation with me, because when I started, it was like, here's your budget, and you can just, it says use it for this, but you can use it for anything you want to. You just kind of has to come out to the at the end of the year so we don't lose money. So now I guess when I budget, I'll have to be a lot more careful about, you know, moving things around.
It's fun.
Oh, yes.
Yep.
So here's a little snapshot of some of our residents. Having fun, lots of Christmas activities going on. I know they had a lot of fun participating in the Christmas parade. Yeah. And we also had Robin and Sarah, who were here, and they got their Queen Elizabeth II Platinum Jubilee Medal, which was lovely. They were both very touched. I got very emotional when I was speaking about them, and I had to look at the other one while I was speaking about the other one because I didn't want to cry. I think, and that's why I wrote this, because the staff at Hillsview are exceptional. These are people who care about the residents like they're their family, like they are their family, and they are truly what makes this property, in my opinion, the exceptional place that it is. And I wanted to leave on that impression, because I think of everything. We really do need to be very grateful that they're all, it is not an easy job. By any stretch, it is not an easy job, but they all do it with such a smile, and they are truly the heart of Hillsview. So, do any of you have any questions?
Are there any questions or any comments? That was a lot of useful information. I mean, we had it in the package, but the further explanations of it was wonderful. Any other questions?
I just have a question. So there was somewhere in that presentation about 12% of your residents are waiting for long-term care, to get into a long-term care home. And then you also had noted earlier that the difference between Hillsview versus the Manor is that you don't have RNs, I believe, was it, or nurses
right.
at night?
Nurses at night.
Right. So is the province looking at doing anything about that funding, since that 12%
great
is
question.
Significant?
I mean, absolutely, we're going to be looking at that, certainly with any budgeting for any funding that's
right.
being available, because it's exactly where my mind went to.
Right, because
okay,
your
so
risk
now,
or the risk to the residents and the risk to your staff
right.
is now increased if
so
they can't get into long-term care.
Sorry, go, you.
You sure?
Yeah.
And that's where that is a fantastic example of how if I just handed you the budget that we get for Hillsview Acres, what you just described is not in the budget, but it's a reality. And so that is where you have to make decisions and say sorry later, but you won't have to say sorry later because the department knows. That's a very easy decision to rationalize, right? But this document, this budget that you get, does not reflect that need.
But we do have a system in place to support our residents, no matter what, because whether you're reassessed to be needing long-term care or not, there's still things happen.
Right.
So that is why we have on-site nursing 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. There's Candace or myself who is available. Our staff that are in place overnight are very well trained and experienced, and they have the support of local agencies. So whether it's we have the first responders come out and do an assessment, or we send someone to hospital, we do that on a regular basis when required. And I have to say the community has really supported us tremendously with that need. When we make a call and we ask for help and we need to send someone, we are very fortunate. Sometimes it's not always the location of choice, so we've had to send people to Roseway, we've had to send them to Bridgewater.
Mm-hmm.
We know that's the reality of Queen's General Hospital at the moment. But there is a really good safety plan in place, but I went exactly where you did when I realized that and said, okay, we're going to go after some more money, or we're going to figure this out, because I do see that in the future. If that number continues to grow and it becomes an issue and they want to support us keeping people safe while they're waiting for long-term care placement, then yeah, we're going to have to go after some more money, 100%.
I mean, you did see the significant increase in the 288 versus 130 per day.
The
per diems. And that's huge, because those people who are waiting for long-term care do require long-term care level of care, which we are not staffed to do.
Absolutely.
Right? So this is where it has been a blessing really for me to work closely with Andrew and Anya, because they have more exposure to that end of managing the facility. So I've learned so much. I've learned that I can go and I can ask these questions. I mean, the worst that they're gonna say is no, but even going through the budget, we're expected to have, you know, a fully staffed kitchen. But if you do the math, they didn't give us enough money to pay someone in the kitchen 10 hours a day, 7 days a week. There's not enough, you do the math, there's not enough money in the budget that they give us for that. So that's where you get the whole massage thing around. But yeah, so it's, yeah, that's been good. And I, to that end, I would just, and I should have mentioned it when we did the staffing slide, we will be doing interviews for the administrator position this week. So hopefully we'll have an update on that in the next couple of weeks for you.
And just quickly, it's an important point, because, you know, we're not here to talk about the new facility, but it is important to consider that the delta between the acuity of care that's required in long-term care and residential care is narrowing, very much so. And the fact, if you think of this, we've got vacant beds at Hillsview Acres.
Mm-hmm.
Good luck finding a long-term care facility with vacant beds in Nova Scotia right now. So that speaks to something, that things are changing. We're shifting towards home care and home support and keeping people home longer, which means that when they do need facility care, it's long-term care, not residential care. So that really is going to speak to ratios in that new facility. Now, you know, it's easy to kind of flip the switch from a residential care bed to a long-term care bed. Like, it doesn't really, that's not difficult to do, but it does, in terms of planning long-term, it is something that we have to think about. What are the trends and where are we going?
Any other further questions? Councillor Brown.
I'd like to thank you all for the presentation. It gives us an idea of the challenges that they're facing out there, and the challenges that we as a council may end up having to face if things go south on us. So it's better to be prepared.
So you have you just said you just filled the 25th bid. You've got 24 bids still to fill. Why aren't they filled? I guess is there a reason for this? That's money to you, right? When you're
still get the money. So So we still are funded for our 29 beds. So if they're not full, then we're still funded for the 29.
Okay.
So in a way, it's an advantage, but we want to be as full as possible because the Department of Seniors and Long-Term Care could pull that money.
Yes, because if they understand that you aren't using it and they're full, then they're going to say, hey, we're...
There will be a reconciliation. At least, I haven't been on that end at Hillsview, but with us, there's a reconciliation they do at the end of the fiscal year around those empty beds. The way they do it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me because there are a lot of fixed costs that come whether you fill beds or not. I'm not answering your initial question. Why are they empty?
Yeah, I mean, I sort of wondered that myself and come to the conclusion that kind of where Andrew was going was that the level of frailty, if they can manage at home, they will. They'll have, you know, an older sibling or a parent or someone who they can be housed with. So that is sort of still happening, and to speak to what Andrew said about people staying at home longer. And then they need long-term care.
Mm-hmm.
So when they're assessed at home in the community for needing long-term care, they're not going to come to us. We will be bypassed in that process.
But they look at the end of the year, and you were averaging 23, 24 beds, and you got a 29-bed unit, they could say, hey, look, you're not utilizing everything. We're not going to pay you for all these vacant spots. Like, I go up to the hospital. I work up the hospitals up. And I see these people all ready to go away to homes. Now, some of them are into a different care. They're into the Queen's Manor more so than what would be Hillsview.
Yeah.
But there are still some that are capable of getting around. Well, if they're still waiting and you've got bids open, that doesn't compute to me.
Yeah, it speaks to the level of care they require.
Yeah.
That's the majority that you're seeing are people that require, this is my assumption, would be people that require that higher level of care.
Okay.
Placement occurs at the provincial level, not at the facility level.
I see.
Right.
Okay.
So it's not that Anya and the team at Hillsview aren't filling
the beds.
Yeah, they don't
have a choice.
We get what we are told to do.
Okay.
Yeah, we're ready.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
I think there's pressure on the system there.
Mm-hmm.
So what assessments that were done in a certain time
right.
a few years ago are not happening at that same rate. And there's different reasons for that. Because we really do rely on the province and placement to say, okay, we're sending you a package. We're waiting every day. We're looking at the computer, waiting for the next person to come. And they're not coming. And we're in communication with the folks at the hospitals. And, you know, we keep all that open and, everyone's looped in. I can't give you the exact answer. I really don't know. Those are speculative.
It is need. I really think it comes down to need and the transition from...
Right.
The transition in philosophy of care, we want to keep people home longer, which is fantastic,
absolutely.
But it means that the need changes at that point of needing facility-based care.
Yeah. Can I ask another question?
Councillor Brown's been waiting.
I just saw recently in my family that somebody went into needed long-term care, and when the decision was coming up, it was where can they get them placed? There's available vacancies, but they're not close to home, so they couldn't go and visit. So sometimes people are opting to wait longer to try to get the placement that they want because they know that they can't switch afterwards, or it's a lot harder to switch. I think that may have some indication there.
Certainly impacts it, yep.
Does anyone other councillor wish to speak before I recognize Deputy Mayor Fancy again? Deputy Mayor Fancy?
Okay. I'd love to talk. I know that sometimes I think what it goes with was what Councillor Brown is saying, that you have an option for the first time of option of saying no. But if you refuse a second time, then you're going to be put down the list, so you can be able to if you're too far in the distance. But I was going back to the emergency funding, the $5,000 for the emergency funding, over $5,000. With the elevator, I mean, I know we have a pocket money out there in Hillsview that we could dip into if you needed to do that. So on something like that, if the elevator were to break down, we could possibly do this and then apply to the over the emergency funding.
We do that all the time.
Okay, so that wouldn't be like you did it already and now I'm asking for the money. No, that's still workable.
Quite often if it's an emergency.
Yeah.
You obviously have to fix it.
Mm-hmm.
So
right.
you dip into your contingency to do that and then recoup later.
Okay.
And that's certainly not something that I would do on my own. That would be a Joanne coming to council and saying, I need to go into just hoping that it won't.
Yeah, and I've never had, to be honest, I've never had emergency funding requests declined.
Okay.
And that's, I don't think that's based on my eloquent writing. I think it's, they recognize when emergencies are emergencies.
It's when you get the money is when the issue is.
But
yeah.
Hillsview
pretty
has,
quick.
But Hillsview has had emergency funding
yeah.
okay.
denied.
Any
yeah.
other further questions? Thank you, Anya.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Wonderful
to
for council to meet you and Andrew. Council, I'm familiar
great
with you.
Back.
And thank
yeah.
the pair of you for your help and what I know is going to be continual help for a while yet. Good luck
yep.
on that
yeah.
new project and thank you, Ms. Vino.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Merry Christmas, everybody.
Merry Christmas.
7.1, letter of mandate school committee. There is a recommendation between Councilor Charles.
I move that Council of Regent of Queens Municipality approves the letter of mandate from the school committee.
And that's seconded by Councilor Amaro. And as you know, we have discussed this in many, many sessions. The paperwork was all in our last package, which rather than recycle, you should bring it with you, but I did notice it was handed out again. I'd just like to make one note, and that is if there are any questions made of the committee, all media requests will be directed to the committee chair rather than the mayor, because the mayor does not speak to this subject, which is kind of unusual, but it is in the mandate. So are there any questions of Eric, of Mr. Levy, before I call the question? I'll call the question. All those in favor? Contrary? Passed. Operation policy, Mr. Levy is going to stay there. 7.2, public art.
Yes, so we
need a motion first.
Just clear my throat.
Do I make a point of order on this?
Yes.
The policy, we're already in operation policy 3.
Policy
3 is
that what you wanted to?
Yes.
If I may, yeah, it was pointed out to me today that there is already policy 3 that I overlooked when I was looking at the listing, so this will actually be policy 5.
That was operational policy 3, 1 through 3. Okay, 5. It was operational policy 5. If someone wants to make that motion and make that change, Councilor Charlton?
I move that the Council of Regent and Municipality adopt operational policy 5, public art, dated December 13, 2022.
And then seconded by Councilor Brown. Are there any questions of our clerk on this matter? Hearing none, I'll ask the question. All those in favor? Ad hoc communications. 7.3, strategy review committee. I'll make that motion. Councilor Muse.
I move that Council of Regent Queens Municipality approve the creation of an ad hoc communication strategy review committee and appoint Council Maddie Charlton and Council David Brown to the committee.
Seconded by Councilor Romero. And this was brought forward from both council and staff. Note that it has been many years since our communication strategy has been looked at or reviewed. I believe it was first brought forward at the time of all water closure, and it was about 5 years ago. Or yeah. So, any other questions of our clerk? Has the staff appointments been made yet?
No, there's been several people interested, but those appointments will happen either soon or shortly after we return in the new year.
All those in favor? Contrary? Removal of shrubs.
Oh, yes. I move the Council of Regent Municipality request the Traffic Authority and the Department of Engineering and Public Works prioritize the removal of any shrubbery that obstructs sod and just leave grass there, it would be a lot better, because, you know, it is a hazard with the little cars, you can't see.
And I know people have asked me about what he was talking about, and it's when you're coming up from the Bank of Montreal, up in front of the financial pages and all of that. If you're coming up that way and you go to turn a left, anyone zipping in off of Market, coming in around that corner, and those little low cars, those Nugu pines, completely block that, block them. Grass or flowers. So, Councilor Brown?
Could this be solved by making that a no left turn? If we made that street right turn only, there's lots of places in the parking lot. People go over a couple of lanes, they can go out and make a left turn where they've got view. If you made that one street right turn only, then you take away the hazard without taking away nice shrubbery. I mean, it's a suggestion. It may not work.
And it's not the right. Which is in front of us. Councilor Brown?
Is this something that actually requires a recommendation of council to ask for this to be done?
Not specifically.
That's what I was uncertain of the last time. I thought it was weird that we had a motion, but to make sure to follow through, I guess, my understanding.
So I know Councilor Muses is a safety concern.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. So if with the withdrawal of the mover and seconder and traffic authority being notified of the safety concern, then he could make, the traffic authority could make a choice of either no left turn or removal of the shrub. It could rest, it could also go that route, but it would require the draw the motion or the
I'm
defeat.
I believe in the motion.
Or clearly, so required defeat of the motion. Any other comments? All those in favor? Contrary? Passed.
Thank you.
Mr. Wayne. So our Director of Economic Development is not here. However, there is. Let's make the recommendation and then we'll note the follow-up. Councilor Charlton?
I move that the Council of the Region of Queens Municipality provide a funding contribution towards the cost of creating a bioeconomy development zone at a cost of up to $10,000 to be funded from existing economic department budget.
And I'm seconded by Councilor Brown. Several meetings ago, Director Lane brought this matter forward. You'll notice there is a bit of new information on the budget impact. Chester has approved a similar recommendation on the 10th of November. So the budget impact to the region of Queens is now expected to be less than $10,000 as per the motion. Any questions that
get some info on
this.
I'm on the Western Woodlots Association committee. There's more committees out there looking at the same thing. I'm not sure why we're going to have another one set up. Westport is one of the things. They look at a 100-year forest street. You know, keep the forest street going for 100 years. They have committees set up to look at biomass and how much is out there, what's being wasted. So I'm not in favor of another committee.
Any other comments? And I cannot answer your question as to why the Nova Scotia Innovation Hub is seeking forward this. All I know is when I thank you for your input as on the West Coast committee. I just know from the BDOZoom org, it's global in nature, and I'm uncertain if Westfor is reaching globally to global companies.
resolution that the Council of Region of Queens Municipality give notice of its intention to enter into a development agreement with 333-2373 Nova Scotia Limited to allow for a multiple unit dwelling on property identified as PID number 700-55058 and located at 6755 Highway 3 in Hunts Point. And that a public hearing be held on January 10th, 2023 in the council chambers of the municipal building, 249 White Point Road in Liverpool, Nova Scotia at 9 a.m.
And that's seconded by
Yep, just a little bit of background there, Norman. The planning department has received an application from the owners of the property at 6755 Highway 3 in Hunts Point to enter into a development agreement that will allow him to convert the existing seven-unit fixed-roof overnight accommodation to a multiple-unit residential dwelling. The property is located in the Hamlet Core zone under the land use bylaw, which doesn't permit as of right multiple unit dwellings with more than four units. But council did include provision within the planning strategy to allow them to consider multiple unit dwellings of greater than four units through the development agreement process. The items, the MPS also points policy outlining the things that council takes into consideration when looking at development agreement applications, and that falls under policy 6-21 of the MPS, so that's included in the staff report. So the property particulars, the property PID number 700-55058 is approximately 10,450 square feet in area, has 135 feet of frontage on Highway 3. The area itself is a mix of low density residential and commercial development. As I've indicated earlier, there is an existing seven unit fixed roof overnight accommodation building on the property. Parking, there's nine parking stalls which currently service the fixed roof accommodation. So there's no intent to change the structure of the physical structure of what's on the property right now. It's essentially to change to strictly change the use of the current building. It's located on a provincially owned and maintained public road, and the access is directly off of the highway number 3. And there's on-site services, water and sewer servicing the property. So there's just a couple of particulars. There's a couple of potential options. One is to maintain status quo and deny the development agreement request, or the second is to enter into the development agreement for the change of use. Staff have looked at the application and the particulars of the surrounding area and are of the opinion that changing the use from a short-term rental to long-term residential use would have negligible impact on the surrounding area. The Planning Advisory Committee met on December the 5th and discussed the application and concur with that and feel that there's adequate provision can be incorporated within the development agreement to mitigate any potential impacts that